Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Our guest is North Carolina's most beloved author, Lee Smith, our neighbor from up in Hillsborough. Lee is going to give the keynote address at the North Carolina Writers Network Fall Conference this year, November 20th and 22nd in Asheville. And she's going to lead a workshop called Believe It or Not, Fact or Fiction. And so I've asked her to come in and, we're going to talk about what she's going to be talking about at this wonderful event for the Writers Network. Lee, welcome.
Thank you.
So you've written numerous, gosh, I don't know how many novels, but I mean, too many to count.
I'm not sure myself.
And and it's not that you haven't written nonfiction before, but you've never had a book of nonfiction. And we've, so you are able to wrestle with the question with other writers about what are the challenges, how are they different? Well, here, what are you going to tell? What is the difference?
Well, although I have done the occasional nonfiction piece over all these years, mainly I'm just totally a storyteller, a fiction writer. And coming from my background, you know, because I grew up in the Appalachian Mountains and was lucky enough to hear oral storytelling. I was in a family of storytellers and of older people. And so all through my childhood, I would fall asleep in somebody's lap on somebody's porch listening to the story, which always, ever since, has come to me in a human voice. Because and usually the voice of somebody that loved me telling a story. So when I write, it's like somebody's talking to me and they're just telling a story and I'm just kind of trying to get it down. So that's been my experience of writing. It's always fiction. It's always a story about a person and a human voice. And so this book is really quite different.
It is quite different.
For
although in your prior life, you write about, you mentioned that you've been... You were a reporter first.
I was. Yes. When I was young, I was a reporter on the Tuscaloosa News in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, shortly after college. But again, I had a hard time, D.G., being a reporter because I would keep making up the quotes, you know, and kind of embellishing things. I never got caught. Never got caught. Somebody would always call me back up, you know, these politicians. They say, well, honey, you did a real good job in your little piece. And I would have made up the whole quote. So I did try journalism early on.
You didn't really do that, did you?
Did you
really make up the story?
I did do that. No, not the story. I just made them sound better. I just made their quotes sound
better. You would adjust the quotes. You would help them with their quotes.
Yes, and I would make things fit together and so on. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, that's the problem. I mean, I've always found, personally, that I can tell the truth better in fiction than nonfiction, because in real life, things don't always happen in an order that makes sense or any sense. And you can't really, you know, you can't find an order in fiction. You can have things happen in a way that has meaning.
You can make legitimate adjustments to the story.
You can make legitimate adjustments for the story. For the needs of the story. And so in nonfiction, you really can't. I cheated a little bit. But I have to say, for a young fiction writer, there is no better job than working on a daily newspaper and going to wrecks and going to funerals and just every kind of thing. And because you have entree, big entree, at key crucial moments into the lives of people that you would never, ever have met otherwise. And it was just an eye-opener for me. It was absolutely wonderful to have this job and to have had other, you know, short-term newspaper jobs and assignments. I have loved that. And mainly, and oral history work, too, because, you know, the real world is there for fiction. But I've usually used it
So you take nonfiction and then adjust it to make the kinds of stories that tell the truth as you see it.
Truth as you see it,
whereas the real accurate point-by-point story would not make the point as well, or the truth would not come out as well as it does if
Well,
you
it does,
it.
But oftentimes it's a different truth. I think with fiction, you're going for the life of the spirit. you know, the truth of the human condition. I mean, that's what else you want to write about, you know? Nothing. And so, I mean, you're going for something, you're going for a kind of meaning that is more than necessarily a recital of events, a recital of plot. Although, of course, plot is very important in fiction. So they're very different, and it's quite, although I've done shorter pieces, it's quite recently that I got this idea that I really wanted to do some serious nonfiction, memoir type even, you know, because I think mainly it's because I am, as we're suggesting here, a writer who's has been so linked to place, to the human voice, to people speaking out of their particular place in the world and in time and circumstance and so on. And place has been so important to me. And in the past 10 years, my hometown has been completely eradicated, literally, as due to a flood control project.
Just talk about
this.
Yeah,
and I went up there, for instance. I mean, I grew up working in my daddy's dime store. And, you know, that was the lot. Our life was running that dime store. And I grew up there to see him blow up the dime store. I mean, I went up there to see him blow up the dime store, which was the most astonishing thing, maybe. To see it all go, to see the place disappear.
Well, let me ask you this.
And that was several years ago. And then only this past summer, they demolished my home, my, you know, my parents' only house that they'd ever lived in. They demolished that. So something about seeing these places of story or something, or of, I don't know, seeing them just gone made me want to replace them with words. That's the way I take a
picture.
Well,
this is your new book coming out in a few months called Dime Store is a collection of your nonfiction. And you include a poignant description of the disappearance of your hometown in the context of your memories of the hometown and the dime store. But now you I just want to ask you this question.
Yeah.
I want you to, but you mentioned the poignant moment when they blew up the building in which the dime store that you really grew up in.
Yeah.
But then you also witnessed the time when your dad closed the dime store and those last moments.
Gosh.
And tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, of course, I had gone up there. The reason he closed the dime store, he was such a good businessman, and the reason he closed it was due to lack of business. The whole town had become a ghost town. Nobody would run a store there because it constantly kept flooding. And so it was just a really bad idea. And the coal business was failing, going down. And so he finally, along with everybody else in the town, or most of them, closed his store. So I went up there, of course, for the going out of business sale in 1992. And the very last thing I remember was the fixtures, you know, and the shelves and things. And I left to come back and come home and teach my classes at North Carolina State. And on the very last day, all the merchandise was gone. Only the people were coming to pick up the fixtures. And that night, Daddy fell at home and broke a number of ribs and started having internal bleeding. And they called me, and by the time I got up there, he only lasted, you know, 3 or 4 hours and died. So he literally died on the last day of his going out of business sale, which was heartbreaking. But also, nobody knew what he would do with himself when the dime store was gone, because he spent all day, every day there. There was a lunch counter. It was a gathering place for the whole town. The girls at the lunch counter fixed him his supper, and he took it back home. This is after Mama died. And, you know, it was his life. But honestly, if one of my writing students had written a story in which the store owner died on the last day, I would have said, I would have put trite.
No, you made that up. That doesn't happen.
No.
But it probably, but it probably does happen. The same day, when we lose the reason, when we lose everything that was surrounding us, that if we were holding on, holding everything together, that pulling that rug out from under us.
Absolutely. And so my dad's story, while it's, you know, his story, I just loved him so much, and it's his story.
But in a way, it's the story of businesses in America, all these small mom-and-pop stores, you know, the dime store, the hardware store, the little men shop, all of these stores. And, you know, so it's a bigger story in a way than the story of my dad's dime store and the story of Grundy, which is now valiantly trying to remake itself, and I'm kind of following that up too. But it's what's happened, I think, in America.
Well, now you've been back there, and I went to Google Maps to try to get an idea about what was all the land that had been scraped off for the flood control. And you mentioned your daddy's dive store is not there, but folks have got a Walmart there now. And what is that a good thing?
Well, you know, of course, I think it's a terrible thing. I'm the dime store owner's daughter. But if you had lived in a town when after they blew up 60 stores, okay, there was no stores at all, you would have to have
the
been—
The highway runs along, or the highway or the main
the
street sort
the
of.
The main street is right. The highway, and it runs right along the river. So it always flooded. So after this flood control project began and the downtown, these stores were all demolished, there has been no place for people to shop without driving, you know, 45 minutes to Richlands or an hour down to Pikeville, Kentucky. So, you know, they were really glad to see the Walmart come. Everybody says the Walmart instead of Walmart. So I always say it too. But anyway, so what they did is they blew up. Took the top off of a mountain across from the town, across the river, made 16 flat acres, which wouldn't have existed without.
And this was all to relocate the town. It wasn't for some other purpose.
No, it was all to relocate the town. But what happened was actually once, and the town fathers alone, I think among small towns in America, invited Walmart to come instead of trying to keep them out. They invited them. And so Walmart, once the news happened that Walmart was coming, other small merchants, you know, along those stores that were, you know, that were closed and, you know, and demolished, they did not move over there. So now what you've got is just Walmart. And it's a super Walmart. It's three stories high, has parking building to the first two floors or a parking building, the last. And you have giant escalators that you can roll your whole cart onto that go up and down. I mean, it looks like a spaceship that's landed over there. And it's just wild. But I have to tell you, I mean, you can imagine my feelings being up in the Walmart, you know, and looking down on the whole little town. And the little town looks like one of these toy train sets that Daddy had in the dime store. But if you live there, you would be really glad to have a place to buy towels and to buy all sorts of things. And so I think people, you know, they are certainly shopping there and certainly using it. And but again, this is a microcosm of what is happening all over America, where these big stores, you know, Walmart, Home Depot, whatever it is, are taking over, and they are, you know, they are not the centers of community. No matter how much they try, you know, that these smaller places were. So it's an interesting story. I mean, yeah, this is my story, but it's really interesting to me also because it's a much bigger story.
We're visiting with Lee Smith. We're talking about her transformation from fiction writer to nonfiction writer, and she's telling us a little, giving us a brief preview of her upcoming book, Dime Store. We'll continue that conversation after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Lee Smith. Lee is going to be the main speaker at the North Carolina Writers Network fall conference this year on November. I get this right. November 20th and 22nd in Asheville. And she's going to talk and lead a workshop and on the themes, I think, Lee, of the bridge between fiction and nonfiction, and you've created it now because this is your first nonfiction book.
And it's harder. It was like pulling my own teeth. It's really hard because, you know, I would write a sentence and then I would say, well, is that true?
I'd keep looking at it. And I'd say, well, is that true? I don't know. I mean, it's just what I think, but I'm supposedly writing nonfiction. I mean, it was really, it's a very different animal, you know. It's a very different kind of enterprise.
So the truth slows you down?
The truth slows you down, yeah. It slows you down.
I'll tell you
something. And you can't, it's very hard to manipulate the truth to illustrate a theme, for instance, that you want to illustrate. Very rarely do events seem to make sense. You know, a lot of times the real events of our life are more chaotic than not.
Yeah. Well, I talked to a guy the other day who reads a lot. He's not a writer, but he reads a lot. And he said, there's no such thing as nonfiction. He said, because even in writing our nonfiction, we select the facts that we're going to give. And we have a point of view that overcomes our, even if we're trying to be objective about something.
That's absolutely
right. He said, if I write about a book, He played for Dean Smith. He says, if I wrote a book about Dean Smith, that's my book about Dean Smith. Somebody else would write something totally different, but my vision of who he is frames what I'm going to say about him.
Absolutely, and I think that's very important to remember. It's always the writer's book. You know, it's the events that are chosen, the story that is chosen to tell, the choices, the way it's told. All of that informs it. So it may be, quote, true, but it's very much shaded by the choices that the writer makes, I think, certainly.
Well, in your book, Dime Store, I think that the choices that you make to tell your truth about them show that you can tell your story in nonfiction by the selection and rhythms and where you tell particular pieces of the story.
Well, thank you, but it's very, you know, but it is very much selected, and I realized somebody else growing up in that town at the same time as I did would have a very different story, possibly.
Well, here's where I want to go with this.
Yeah,
I'm going to try to take charge of this story.
Do it.
This is terrible. Is that the nonfiction writer, as we say, has the choices to make to order, like a fiction writer does in some respects, how that story is told and what facts to use. So that I want to argue with the friend who told me, well, there's no nonfiction, it's all fiction. No, it's not fiction, it's nonfiction, but that doesn't mean that the author has given up control of the
And also, I think, and I did a really thorough, I was teaching a course in this, and I did a really thorough look at nonfiction personal narrative books, you know, that I thought really came to life, and I was trying to see why they came to life.
And why?
For instance,
tell us why.
Like The Glass Castle, Jeanette Walsh. Like, let's just talk about that for a minute. Or Cheryl Strayed. Cheryl Strayed, Wild. You know, about the woman that walked the Pacific Northwest Trail.
What brings them to life?
Well, I think that you should use the fiction writer's bag of tricks. And in particular, so many times when we start telling something that's about us, we don't tell all the details that we would about a character because we know it's about us. You know, we don't describe us. We don't give a background on
us. Put the magnifying glass on ourselves.
You have to do that, And particularly, you are a character, particularly if you're using the I point of view. The reader is only interested in the story if they know who that is that's telling them the story. So you have to tell a little bit about
yourself. The narrator in not in all nonfiction, but in the nonfiction
personal narrative,
you do have to examine yourself as a character.
You have to let people know who you are.
How do you do that?
Who's telling them this story?
Well,
tell them about your past. Tell them about your ideas and beliefs and hates and loves and hopes and dreams so they will know what this story's going to mean to you. You know, this thing. I mean, just let them in on who you are. And so, and also, I think, so think of yourself as a character and develop yourself a little bit. Be generous. Let your reader know who you are. Introduce yourself.
Bad things about yourself as well as good things?
Yeah. If you just tell good things, nobody will like you. Nobody will want to read it. I love the flaw, you know, in the character. But the main thing, I think, too, another main thing is to use scene development. Don't just sigh. My parents and I were very close. We had a happy home.
Oh, good.
Then what you want to do is show one of those, show Christmas or show, you know, a meal with everybody talking and what are they eating and who's there and what are they thinking and what are they wearing and everything. Just give some parts of the life of the page in enough detail so the reader really feels that the reader is there. When I use scene in that sense, I don't mean what do things look like, although that's important too, but I mean let the reader really feel that they're there, a part of things. As you know, for instance, in the book in the dime store, there's a scene where I'm going into the Walmart for the first time, and the reader gets to go with me, and I tell enough detail so the reader.
You go up the escalator. You go up this big escalator. You look out the window.
All these memories.
No. I tell you what I love is that you run into your friends who said, "Don't you just love this Walmart or something like that?" So you treat me to the experience that you had, bad and good and ambiguity.
Yeah, and for instance, at the beginning of The Glass Castle by Jeanette Walls, who also grew up in Virginia, she is in a taxi, obviously very dressed up, obviously going out for an evening out, which tells us a lot about her and who she is at that point. She looks out, and there's a full development scene here. She looks out the window of the taxi, and she sees her mother scrounging food out of a dumpster. Her mother lives on the street by choice. And that's where
Instead of just saying my mother lives in the street, you describe that scene
and she describing the mother, describing the dumpster, describing how she looks and what she's grabbing out of there. And then we see the situation of the daughter and we have the daughter's feelings, and that's where we start. See, and we are so drawn in. We want to know how this happened. We want to know the childhood. We want to know all this. And she's going to proceed to tell us. So there's nothing really as powerful, I think, as scene development, you know, as you go along through. You can also have big periods of narration where you're given facts, you're given figures, you're given statistics, you're doing all kinds of other things with a different kind of writing. But really, narrative is really composed of, if it's strong, I think it's composed of scenes, you know, fully developed with narration in between. It's like a string of beads.
So it's like a string
of beads. And so you got to have a few beads.
So you haven't parked your storytelling gifts and
training. I sort of did at first, and then I just found that it was very flat. You know, so I thought,
I did this and I did that, but not really.
Not
here's what
detail.
Happened. Here's
right.
What.
Not how I felt and blah, blah, blah. So to have some scenes along, I think, is really important writer.
When you are talking to a Writers Network workshop, what are you gonna tell people? Or are you gonna make them talk to you? I mean,
I'm gonna get them to talk a lot. I think I love to do that and hear what they're trying to write and what they have to say and. You know, what questions and all come up. I mean, a big one is always, well, you know, is my family going to hate me when they...
and the answer is yes.
Will they speak to me at Thanksgiving?
If it's good, the answer is yes.
That's true. If it's honest, it's not going to please everybody. Mm-hmm. And you have to take that into consideration. Do you really want to write this? Do you really want to write this? If so, why? I mean, one man told me, he said, I'm going to get even.
Well, let me ask you.
there was motivation. It's not most people.
It's so much fun, but we need to take a break. But
yes.
There are lots of us who have had lots of great experiences. We're not going to be able to write a memoir that's going to be saleable, but... the point I want to make is... Or if you'll help me, but maybe you will have to say, DG, this doesn't work this way. But I wondered, as you read things that you've written before about your life, do you just say, oh, that's no good? Or do you say, oh, boy, I'm so glad I recorded that because I've forgotten it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because I think to me that is the great gift of the memoir is the gift to the self.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you're saying something. You're saying, you know— this is my life. I was here, and this is who I was. This is who I am right now writing this. And you forget that. But when you read what you've written, it's like that, you know, that girl you know, sitting in the woods in Chapel Hill, comes right back to life. Who was she? What was she thinking?
When she first came down and faded this drunk SAE on the...
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah. When she dumped that drunk SAE, she was writing some stuff in her little notebook. Who was she? What was she thinking? There she is. And I might have forgotten
that incident altogether. It's a gift
to yourself. It's a gift to yourself, and you've got to say, I'm important. I take myself seriously. And you know what? You will be so glad, because when you get to my age, you have forgotten so many of those important things. So, and I think, too, there's a great quote that I have quoted in Dime Store. Peter Taylor, the writer who spent a lot of time actually in Chapel Hill, he taught at UNC Greensboro for years too, but he said once, I never know what I think till I read what I've written. but then you do, and you will remember who you are at that particular moment in time. And it's, you know, it's a great gift to yourself to have it, I think. And also, I find the minute I get my pencil in my hand, I'm still writing longhand, the minute I get my pencil in my hand or get before the computer or something, that's when the memories come. That's when the details come. They don't just come unless you're actually writing. The act of writing makes you remember more. And you
opens
go back
the
next day and you see what you wrote. Yeah. And you'll remember more and more. And so the act of writing is very helpful, because we want to know who we are, right? We don't want to live an unexamined life.
Well, if you join us late, the great storyteller Lee Smith is telling us about what it's like to write nonfiction and how it fits, and she's going to tell us more after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Lee Smith. We're really talking about this in connection with two things that have happened. One is Lee's upcoming appearance at the North Carolina Writers Network's fall conference, where she's going to deliver the main address and lead a workshop. I think the dates are November 20th and 22nd in Asheville. And the other is her upcoming first book of nonfiction called Dime Store, based on her father's dime store in Grundy, Virginia. And Lee, it's been so much fun to talk to you. I want to ambush you because I'm reading Dime Store right now in an early version, but you took me back to my home, brought back memories to me when you talked about going to Bristol.
Yeah,
to the Buster Brown store, where I also watched my toes in that X-ray machine. It probably filled me full of
bad things. And your bones were green, right?
But my memory varied from you, because I'm sure that Buster Brown store was on the Tennessee side of Bristol.
Well, you know, I bet it was. I'm really bad on actual facts.
But you're a nonfiction writer. You got to get that right. Got to get that right. Well, if anybody joined us late, one of the questions when you're talking about the, is there a difference in writing fiction and nonfiction? You know, one of them is, if in nonfiction, are you solidly bound by the facts? Do you have to have a fact checker and somebody to go back? Or if you're writing a memoir, are you able to say, as some memoirists have said, well, maybe it wasn't right, but that's my memory of it. You know, that kind of thing. What are the rules?
I was using, I think, as an example, Jeanette Walls' The Glass Castle, just because I think most of us have read it. And, you know, at the end of that book, she says, my sister remembers things differently. Mm-hmm. So it is all, you know, what really happened is dependent upon who is remembering it and through what lens. You know, what feelings, what acts of grind, what, you know, emotional slant, whatever. So there will always be that. I think that said, we're under an obligation not to just completely make something up and try to pass it off for truth, which, you know, a number of writers have been caught doing recently.
They have,
and we don't
like
that, you know. They shouldn't do that. I mean, if they are supposedly writing nonfiction, they can write it as well. We can all write it as well as possible by, you know, using scenes, using lots of description, using the fiction writer's bag of tricks. But we are trying to tell the truth here, at least the truth as we see it. You know, we're not out to just completely picture someone as they never were.
Well, this is not a rule that you can. It's like having a wide out of bounds line on a tennis court or something.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
Well, again, I'm focusing on what you're going to be talking about, or what you tell nonfiction writers, and the thing that you tell fiction writers, I think, is read a lot. Go read a lot of wonderful books to find out what you like and get examples. What do you tell nonfiction writers?
I think same thing. I mean, you need to read a lot. You need to find a book if you want to write a memoir, if you want to write a nonfiction book. You need to read a lot in this field. You need to, read everything from Frances May's new memoir, Under Magnolias, to Harry Cruz, you know, A Childhood in Georgia. There's every kind of memoir out there. And you need to find one that you're personally resonating with. And then you need to look at it very carefully. You need to use that other side of your brain and say, okay, how is this put together? You know, how much is the writer telling us about herself or himself? And what kinds of things? And how is this written? Why does this work for me? And, you know, you need to find a sort of a model that really resonates with you, yourself. Elizabeth Spencer's memoir, you know, Landscapes of the Heart, which is in a certain way a more distant tone, you know, there. And, you know, if you're a more reserved person, that might really make you understand how you could write your life. I mean, it just depends. But to spend some time looking through and looking through these examples is very, very important, I think, to have a model. In fact, I think sometimes as a teacher, I think my best role has been to, like, match people up, like be a dating bureau. You know, if somebody tells me kind of what they want to write, or they have an early draft of something, I'll say, well, yeah, but why don't you read this and read this and read that? Because this is how so-and-so has used similar material. For instance, an example you'd say from fiction would be when he first stopped being a rural mail carrier and wanted to write, Silas House, the young writer from Kentucky, gave me some of his earliest things and from his Appalachian, you know, background. And it had been a hard life and hard family to deal with, but I felt like his writing was too sweet. He's too nice, you know. And so I gave him Larry Brown. Changed his life, you know. I gave him Harry Cruz and Larry Brown and, you know, all these Southern bad boys. And it really let him say the things he thought maybe he couldn't say and still be loyal to his place.
Wow.
You know, and so that's the kind of thing. Other people who are too flowery, you give them Hemingway, you know, or whatever. But, I mean, there's you know, reading teaches us so much, I think, for a writer. You've got to read, and you've got to, if you know what you sort of want to sound like, you need to find some models,
you need to have
I
a
think.
Part, not a somebody you're going to copy, but somebody who is your
mentor,
Zen master sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Well, exactly. You want to, you know, are you writing a memoir that's a spiritual journey? Read Peter Matheson. I mean, you know, there's always somebody out there, and you can say, okay, how do you do that? You know, what does the snow leopard mean?
Well,
you know,
we're visiting with Lee Smith. We're doing it in the context of her upcoming visit to the North Carolina Writers Network's Fall Conference on November 20th and 22nd, where she'll give the major address and lead a workshop, and also teasing us about her book, first book of nonfiction, Dime Store, which we'll be seeing not soon enough, but sometime soon.
Thank
you. And I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm talking to Lee Smith. Lee's got a book that's coming out in March called Dime Store. It's her first book of nonfiction. And it's a memoir in stories, I think she says. And we've been talking a little bit about the challenge of moving from fiction to nonfiction. But Lee turns out to be a storyteller in both genres. And what, you know, we talked in the break about this wonderful story that you and your husband Hal organized a softball game on Thanksgiving Day for many years.
And you've written about that. The idea was you would have something to do with yourselves while the turkey cooked, and you had all those relatives in your house, and what are you going to do with them? So our idea was everybody should put their turkey in about 10:30 and then go and play softball. And it got way out of hand. It went on for 20-some years, and we would have, I don't know, you know, 20 dogs on the field. We would have 20 people on each, you know, on each side. We'd have children and grown-ups, and it was named the Wild Turkey Classic.
Wow.
It was really fun.
You got something you can read from your upcoming book?
Yeah, I'll just read the very last paragraph. I've been talking here about why we started it, you know, and who's there and everybody. And then I'll just read the last paragraph. Play ball, somebody hollers, and then we do for the next 20 years or so. As the Massengale boys and the Luddingtons grow up before our very eyes and other kids go away and get married and then come back with their own kids, first in strollers and then on the field, another generation. Some people divorce and return with other people. Some people go to graduate school in Iowa or New York or Asheville or Austin, places too far to really come back from. Every year more girls are playing, not only our perennial Elva, a ringer. Bill Luchtenberg is still playing second. Jim Watson still bikes to the game wearing that Duke hat, his hair flying out behind him. On and on it goes, year after year, on sunny Thursdays and cloudy Thursdays and freezing Thursdays, in fog and sleet. The sweet taste of grown-ups, the sweet taste of donuts, the crack of the bat, the screams and yells and laughter of the crowd. Old friends and new, all these dear and changing faces, these lovers of the game.
Will there be
this
lots
makes me cry.
I know it will. Me too. There'll be a lot of other people.
DG has been a player in this game.
it makes me cry too. Of things, it's like you're watching the blast of your blowing up your daddy's dime store, and
yeah.
remembering the sweet things, and then having to deal with the fact that things never stay the same and that
they
you
don't.
Do lose some
right.
of these things. So cry, enjoy the moment of the wonderful moments that you had before, and then try to figure out something else that we can do to make memories today.
Yeah, yeah, right. Well, we are. I mean, we don't have this particular game anymore, but we're you know, surrounded with grandchildren on Thanksgiving.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, Lee, thanks so much for coming. I want to get there's one other story that I found in your new book that's coming out soon, Dime Store, a description of your and your husband Hal's venture into the restaurant business.
Yes.
And we don't have time to really tell the whole story, but you used it as a way to talk about the changing, about many things, but including the changing South and what
yes.
the South is.
Well, I did a little study of the actual piece of land in Carrboro.
Where the Akihana restaurant is.
Where the Akihana restaurant is and is today going great guns. And I found that initially it had been a segregated restaurant with a whites, you know, and coloreds, and it had cooked country cooking, but you could only come in, you know, sit over here. One side was black and one side is white, and there was one kitchen, and you could go either way. I couldn't believe that. But those two restrooms were still there with white and colored covered up, you know. Amazing. So it tells us about the South. I mean, that was an early country kind of restaurant. Before that, it was an Indian trading path.
Wow.
You know, and before that, and a tobacco field, and so on. And it was one where sharecroppers were, you know, and so on. It went on up. And then the first restaurant there, as I say, was the segregated restaurant.
I got you started too late.
But anyway, the things, the kinds of restaurants that were then there from time to time, all the way up to sushi, which the people around kept calling it the bait shop when we were putting it in. They said, nobody's going to eat that.
Oh, well, that's wonderful. And your wonderful example of how a fiction writer turns to writing nonfiction is a wonderful gift to all of us. Thank you, Lee Smith, for sharing it.
Thanks, DG. I appreciate it. Thank you.
And thanks to you for listening. This is DG Martin, who's talking, and I'll be back here before.